Zig inserted the rebent coat hanger into Vaka's nostril, where its wire frame added new structure, and lifted his deflated nose like a circus tent. "I take back what I said." "Now you're showing off," Louisa added. "You could have just psst." The sound came from their left. The doors to the medical suite were closed, but even through the transparent glass, Zig knew that round silhouette anywhere. "I think your friend who runs the vending machines is trying to be subtle," Louisa said. "Are you playing Prince in there?" Dino called out through the door. "I feel like that's somehow ruining Prince for me." Hitting a button, Zig opened the automated doors and pulled the O2 mask from his face, but never stepped into the actual hallway. The embalming fluids had to stay in the sterilized zone. "Dino, what are you doing here?"
"Jiminy Christmas!"
Dino instinctively recoiled from the smell, holding his nose and stepping back from the threshold.
"No matter how many times I'm here... Good God, man, it's on your mask! That was by your mouth! You're wearing glops of dead by your mouth!"
"Dino, this better be an emergency."
"She said it was."
"She?" Zig asked with a look. Dino nodded, still holding his nose.
"Your friend, from the FBI.
Zig knew who he meant. Wags.
"She tried calling you. I told her you don't carry your phone while you're working."
Zig glanced back over his shoulder, checking to see who else was listening. Louisa, Will, and the other morticians were turned the other way, focused back on their respective fallen.
"She find something?"
Zig whispered. Dino gave him that look he had on that night when they met those twins at the bar. "I need at least another hour in here," Zig said.
"Don't you think this might be more important?"
"I need another hour," Zig insisted, pointing a thumb back into the medical suite. Dino knew better than to argue. Rookstool had a wife, two little grandkids. Zig would never leave a deceased while a family was waiting for closure.
"Tell her I'll call her in an hour."
There was a pneumatic hiss as the doors swung shut, and Dino headed up the hallway, already dialing Wags's number. "Mr. Canals," a female voice called out as Dino turned the corner. Dino looked up, spotting an Asian woman in full officer uniform. She had the most penetrating gaze he'd ever seen.
"You have a moment," Colonel Sue said.
"Actually, it wasn't a question. This way, Mr. Canals." Dino stuffed his phone in his pocket and headed hesitantly to her office.
"Can you tell me what this is about?" Dino asked.
"Don't play stupid. It just insults both of us."
34. Homestead, Florida, 11 years ago. This was Nola when she was 15.
"Pencils down," the teacher warned.
Nola kept scribbling.
"Pencils down!"
Nola lifted her chin, her eyes narrowing and disappearing in a black hole of dark eyeliner that only a 15-year-old could think was acceptable. She was in her usual spot in the back row in her usual uniform. Wife-beater tank, boy jeans, secondhand, which her dad hated, and Doc Martens, brand new, which her dad hated even more.
"Me?"
she asked. The teacher made a face. There were only three other kids in the room, all of them boys. Nola was the one girl, which is how it usually was in the unfortunately acronymed CSI, the Center for School Improvement, the place for students who got kicked out of class, which is exactly what happened when Damien D'Abruzzo burped in his hand and threw it at Nola, who immediately socked him in the face. Years ago, both would have been suspended or forced to do community service, like washing jeeps at Homestead's local military base. These days, educators were convinced that the only way to help a student was to keep them off the streets. Hence, CSI, locking kids up in day-long detention.
"So I'm supposed to just sit here and do nothing?"
Nola challenged.
"Blame the Breakfast Club,"
said the teacher, Ms. Sable, a stubby 50-something woman with three hidden tattoos, wary green eyes, and dyed black hair that was supposed to be Betty Page but looked more like Betty Rubble. She hated using her free period to staff CSI, but it paid time and a half, which was the only way to afford the aide who watched her Alzheimer's-stricken mother.
Nola, I'm not saying it makes sense to me either, but rules are rules. Now, pencils down.
Or what?
Ms. Sable rolled her eyes. She had three older kids, all boys, and boys were animals. She didn't take their crap. She certainly wasn't taking this crap. She moved closer.
Nola, see me after class.
I don't have class. I'm locked in here with you all day.
In a blur, Ms. Sable yanked Nola's notebook from her desk.
Hey, that's mine!
Was. See me after class, Sable said, heading back to her desk and flipping through the pages of the book,
more out of habit than anything else. Then she saw what was actually inside. Ms. Sable stopped, turning back to Nola.
Nola, is this your book?
Nola went silent. Had she left something in the notebook?
Nola, did you draw this?
Sable asked, holding the notebook open like a Playboy centerfold. Across two pages was an elaborate pencil drawing of a fat, drooling goblin with leathery wings and a rusty broadsword. The goblin was feasting on a human arm, and below it were the words, Homestead's loudest thrash metal band, the one, the only, pretentious critics.
Nola, did you draw this or not?
It had been 8 years since Nola was abandoned by her adoptive family and handed over to Royal. 8 years of his screaming. 8 years of his mood swings. 8 years of digging holes hidden by different-sized kiddie pools in different-sized backyards. And 8 years of sleeping in the car on Tuesdays and Saturdays. But of all the damage Royal had done, the worst was simply this. She got used to it. It was commonplace. Faced with that tone of questioning, Royal's primary tone in all conversations, Nola's years of conditioning gave her only one logical response.
What did I do wrong?
Ms. Sable was still staring down at the goblin drawing, barely hearing the question. Nola noticed her posture shift.
Nola, this is beautiful.
Confused, Nola searched the teacher's face, looking for the lie, the tell, the flaw in her words. Ms. Sable's nails were a mess. She bit them. Her lower teeth were crooked, needed braces, couldn't afford them. And just above her earrings were two other holes long since closed. Why would someone let an earring hole close? Still, try as she might, it made no sense. There had to be a tell in there somewhere. But Nola couldn't find it.
Nola, do you know what I teach here?
Video production.
And art. I teach art. You know what that means?
Nola shook her head.
It means I know what I'm talking about. You have a real knack for this, girl.
Nola said nothing. And then,
I take wood shop. I don't have art.
You do now. Sixth period. Same smelly room as wood shop. Be there tomorrow.
Ms. Sable tossed the notebook back. It slapped against Nola's desk. At the front of the class, the three boys were turned in their seats, staring. Nola lowered her chin quickly, closing her notebook and hating them for witnessing this feeling she was feeling, this feeling that was twisting her stomach in a grip of confusion, nausea, and something else, something lighter, something she didn't have a word for. For the rest of Nola's life, she'd carry this moment with her, for when she needed it. And she'd never forget the five words she suddenly noticed carved into the desk. Ms. Sable sucks donkey dicks. She would have laughed, but no way was she letting the boys see that. This was Nola at 15, the very first time someone told her she was good at something. 35. Washington, D.C. Today. Marcus was naked. He was inside, on a boat. He was tied to an armchair and blindfolded.
Who's there? Is someone there?
Marcus sat up in his seat. There was a muffled creak. He listened intently. On his right, by the door. Another creak. Outside.
Hey! Hey, I'm in here! I need help! Can you hear me?
Marcus thrashed, his naked legs sticking to the chair from his own dried urine. He was still groggy, still in pain from what that girl, Nola, from what Nola had done to him. Shoved something in his throat. Knocked him out.
I'm in here! Please, help! I need...
There was a pop in the air. On his right. The door opened.
Thank God!
Marcus shouted. He'd never been more wrong.
I thought I'd be stuck here until the morning, Marcus said as someone arrived. I was worried that... Thank God you're here.
Sitting up like a star pupil, Marcus stuck out his chin, waiting for his rescuer to pull off his blindfold. On his face, the black bandana stayed where it was. Confused, Marcus bent his head back, trying to peek underneath. It was still too dark, but Marcus could feel a shift in the air. Someone slowly moving toward him.
Whoever you are, I hear you-
Something swiped at Marcus's face, slicing his blindfold as it fell away. Marcus blinked a few times, his eyes adjusting to the light. But his expression fell when he saw.
You gave us a scare there, Marcus, said a broad-shouldered Native American woman, with jet-black hair pulled tight in a ponytail.
Her crimson-brown skin came from her father's Shoshone side. Ice-blue eyes came from her mother. Marcus hadn't seen her in nearly a year, not since that fiasco in Montana.
Teresa, please,
Marcus begged, smart enough to call her by her real name rather than the one they used behind her back. The curtain. As in, when the curtain comes, it's all over.
I swear on my life, Teresa, I didn't say anything,
he insisted, again using her real name and again thinking he was smart. If he were really smart, he'd know that when it came to being called the curtain, she relished it.
Your friends are worried about you,
the curtain said, standing perfectly still, shoulders back, even with the sway of the boat. Her father taught her the benefits of good posture, just like he taught her how to pitch a good curve, tie a proper fishing knot, even how to skin a rabbit without a knife. Growing up, the curtain knew her dad wanted a boy and got a girl. But when her mom's drug use got worse and turned her into something they no longer recognized, Dad kept his daughter right by his side, storming off the reservation so she'd never be one of them Indians that sits around with gambling money and sucks off the tit of the tribe. It was the curtain's earliest memory. At 7 years old, ducking down in the back of Dad's truck, escaping in the middle of the night. It wasn't until years later that she finally learned what Dad did before they ran off that night. But to this day, it was her father's most potent lesson. The world eats the weak. Hit the hyenas before they feast.
Marcus, remember that restaurant we ate at in Montana? The place with those wonderful buffalo burgers?
Teresa, please! You know I didn't say anything!
What was the name of that place?
The curtain tapped her palm against her thigh. Her hand turned so he couldn't see the ancient weapon she was holding. It was called a Bagnach, also known as a tiger's claw, made of four curved metal blades that are fixed to a crossbar that you grip in your palm. The curtain used it to slice Marcus's blindfold, though it also ripped open a cut on his cheek.
It had one of those kooky names like Tequila Mockingbird, but not that.
I swear on my nieces, not a word. I didn't say a word,
Marcus insisted, finally seeing two drops of his own blood as they hit his lap, dripping from his cheek. He tried to wipe them away, but his hands were still tied to the chair.
Remember that corn with the goat cheese in it? That was divine,
the curtain added, picking up Marcus's clothes from the floor. The pockets of his jeans were empty. He knew not to carry a wallet. His burner phone was on a nearby counter. But as she checked the other pockets,
Marcus, where's your other phone?
I'd never... She asked me all these questions. I didn't tell her anything.
Your real phone, Marcus. Where's your real phone?
I left it in my car. I swear it's not here.
He was sweating now, the backs of his thighs again sticking to the chair. This girl, Nola, I know she found your car. Now she has your phone, doesn't she?
The curtain said as she scanned the rest of the cabin. On the bar was an empty glass and a small plastic lid like you'd see on a prescription bottle.
She drugged you.
She asked questions, but I didn't answer her. She knew about Houdini, asked for him by name, but I didn't say nothing, not a word. You know I wouldn't do that, right?
The curtain stared at Marcus, her body still like she wasn't even breathing.
Teresa, please!
She took a slow step toward him. Tears flooded his eyes. Snot ran from his nose.
Please tell me you believe me!
I believe you, Marcus.
Exhaling, Marcus tipped his head back in relief, at which point Teresa's hand swiped at the air, her tiger's claw slicing a deep gash into Marcus's throat, severing his carotid artery. In the movies, blood sprays everywhere when you slit someone's throat. In reality, it follows the beat of your heart, pumping out and raining down in a slow waterfall. Marcus tried to get out a few final words, but he couldn't. Pulling out her own burner phone, the curtain dialed a number, never taking her eyes off Marcus's now lifeless body. It was another of her dad's best lessons, and an army lesson, too. Make sure the job is done. There was a click as someone picked up. They didn't say a word. Neither did the curtain. Message sent. Then, to the curtain's surprise,
"It was the girl, yes? Nola Brown?"
asked the man with a voice like a wood chipper.
"Don't worry," the curtain said. "I'm on her."
More silence. Another message sent.
"You better be."
Without another word, both hung up.
River House Grill, the curtain thought to herself as she headed for the door of the boat. That was the restaurant in Montana. Fantastic barbecue.
36. "Mr. Canals, I understand you stock our candy machines and manage the Kingpin Cafe, where the soup of the day is always cheese fries," Dino said. Colonel Sue didn't laugh, didn't smile, didn't even blink as she sat there, both hands clamped together on her desk, which held a stack of pamphlets about depression in the military and a gold watch engraved Sue 2028, a gag gift from her staff for her eventual run for president. "I've been to the Kingpin."
"I've never seen you there, Colonel. What's your order?"
"I send my assistant."
"Wait, are you the person who, every few weeks, orders the flatbread with just loads of olives, extra ketchup on top?"
"That person worries me."
"That person should worry you. I'm grilled cheese with tomato and avocado on whole wheat bread."
"That's a reasonable order."
"I'm a reasonable person, Mr. Canals. More reason than you might realize."
Dino shifted in his seat. If she was playing nice. "My assistant told me they call you the Candyman around here."
"That's a great name. Candyman."
"Colonel, if there's something you want to ask me..."
"Mr. Canals, I'm sure you're aware that there's only one set of candy machines here in our particular building.
In the break room."
"Just that room," Sue said.
"And yet, over the past day and a half, security shows that you've been here nearly half a dozen times."
Before Dino could say a word, she added,
"In fact, when I looked closer at it, yesterday, Mr. Canals, when the Secret Service was scanning this place before the President's arrival, you were one of the few people swiped in. That was pretty early in the morning."
"That's my job description. Stock the machines pretty early in the morning."
"What also caught my eye is that, according to those security records, you were in this building around the same time your friend Zig got knocked in the head."
Dino sat up straight, annoyed. Are you accusing me of something?
I'm just pointing out facts.
Zig got me this job. He's a brother to me.
I'm thrilled to hear that, Mr. Canals. Especially because we've all been worried about our friend Zig lately.
You should tell him that.
I'd love to. But that's the problem. I tried calling him yesterday afternoon, and he wouldn't pick up. We even sent someone to his house. No one could find him. It was like he just disappeared.
So talk to him now.
I'd love that as well, but as you saw, he's been in the embalming room for nearly 4 hours. And here I am with so many questions about where Zig was when Sergeant Brown's body shipped out of here yesterday. For the first time, Dino just sat there, saying nothing. Sue's hands were still clamped together, like someone praying. You've heard her name before, haven't you, Mr. Canals? Nola Brown? Again, Dino just sat there. What about the name Marcus Romita? Ever hear of him?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Marcus Romita, from Tucson, Arizona, trained as Special Forces, then got discharged for a pre-existing personality disorder.
That usually means someone was an asshole.
Maybe. But imagine our surprise when Marcus was found dead 2 hours ago on a boat. One that was docked in the Pentagon Marina. Throat slit. Perfect carotid neck cut. Like a pro. Or someone who knows their anatomy. Any morticians come to mind?
Ma'am, you really think Zig would... I'm not accusing anyone of anything. I just want to know where Zig was last night. He wasn't slaughtering people on a boat, I can tell you that.
And I want to believe you, Mr. Canals. But according to some grainy security footage that we're just starting to sift through, a driver who looks a lot like Zig was spotted in that same marina last night. Dino again went silent.
Mr. Canals, I pulled your employment records. Every month, half your check gets garnished to the IRS. Unpaid taxes for nearly 3 years, with foreclosures on, looks like 4 different homes.
That has nothing to do with... Those were legitimate investments.
I understand how the housing bubble worked. When it burst, my sister-in-law made the same exact mess, meaning my brother is still pulling extra night shifts as a dispatcher in the fire station. What I'm driving at, Mr. Canals, is I know how important this job is to you. So if you know anything about Zig, or Nola Brown, or about anything that's going on, we're just trying to help.
By what? By calling me in here and gripping your hands together like some finicky villain in a straight-to-video Nickelodeon movie? You realize I'm going to tell him everything you've said, right? Zig's my family.
I'm not questioning his commitment to you. I'm questioning his commitment to us.
Then you know nothing about him. So if you want to fire me for paying back taxes, fire me. Otherwise, if you've got any problems with my work, report me to the contracting officer's rep. Otherwise, I've got a lunch rush to prepare for, Dino said.
Oh, and putting avocado on grilled cheese? You're turning a good sandwich into a shitty one. Show the grilled cheese some respect. Without another word, Dino headed for the door, slamming it as he left. At her desk, Colonel Sue stared down at her watch, at the words Sue 2028. For a moment, she sat there, hands still clasped. Then she pulled out her phone and texted 2 words to a number that was unlisted. Your turn.
37. You alone or not? Wags asked. Approaching the door scanner, Zig swiped his ID. The lock clicked, and he pushed his way into room 028. Uniform prep.
All alone, Zig said, eyeing 4 faceless, stark white mannequins at the center of the room. Each wore a different uniform. Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, like you'd see in a department store. On Zig's right were dark wood display cases filled with every military badge, ribbon, and medal you can imagine. Purple hearts, silver stars, distinguished service crosses, each encased in plastic, each hanging on its own wire hook, reminding Zig of when he was little, on a trip to Hershey Park, flipping through a display rack of kid-sized personalized license plates, searching the alphabet for his own name. Back then, his mom was still strong and healthy. "You in your office?" Wags asked. "Uniforms," Zig said, scanning the single sheet of paper he was holding in his other hand. At Dover, it was called a rip sheet, a printout of all the medals and badges a fallen service member would wear in their casket. In this room, uniform specialists would assemble and iron the uniform, collect and polish the medals, and get everything ready to dress the corpse. Today, though, Zig decided to give it a little personal touch. At the top of the rip sheet was one name. Rookstool Nelson, VIP, Librarian of Congress. 1. Superior Civilian Service Award. No surprise, Zig thought, pulling a bright silver medal with a crimson ribbon from its wire hook. Presidential friends always got good hardware. 2. President's Award for Distinguished Federal Civilian Service. Also no surprise. Eisenhower established the award so presidents could single out government service. But the third and final medal on the list. 3. Secretary of the Army Award for Valor. Zig paused, reaching the wire rack and pulling out the gold medal with its red and blue ribbon. Wags, did Rookstool ever serve? Pardon? Nelson Rookstool, Librarian of Congress. Yesterday when his body came off the plane, he was received as a civilian. But was he a vet? Afghanistan? Iraq? I don't know, even National Guard or something. Through the phone came the hushed clicking of a keyboard. Nope, never in the military, Wags finally said. Nothing in the Bureau, CIA, or other agencies either. He's full muggle his whole life. Why you asking? Zig pulled the gold medal close, eyeing the engraved five-pointed star. Above it was the word Valor. They're awarding Rookstool a medal for valor. Wags didn't say a word. She didn't have to. Even in the world of secret squirrels, medals for valor were for bravery, which usually meant combat, or at least for doing something in the field. You think when Rookstool was on that plane, Wags began, whatever he was doing in Alaska, he wasn't just there as a librarian? That's the question. Maybe he really was bringing literacy to rural Eskimo communities. Or maybe, considering the names of the dead Houdini assistants who were staffing him on the plane, he was on a mission we still haven't figured out yet. Speak for yourself, Wags shot back. Wait, you found the Houdini folks? And I found Marcus Romita. Who? Last night at Fort Belvoir, the guy who attacked you outside Nola's office. Wide eyes, hit you with a telescoping baton. How do you... His CAC, Wags explained, referring to his military ID. He had to swipe it to get into Fort Belvoir. But when I checked their records, Marcus was the only visitor on base who didn't hand his guest pass back at the end of the night. Find him, and you'll have your best shot for figuring out who's really doing these Houdini tricks. Wags, you're getting sneakier in your old age, you know that? You said Nola ambushed him. I'm guessing she dumped him in his trunk and drove off base. Any idea where he might be now? Wags paused. Would you be surprised if I said a morgue in Virginia? Oh, no. Oh, yes. Police found Marcus dead early this morning, tied to a chair on a boat in the Pentagon Marina. I was there last night. Which probably means that when they run their security tapes, cops are going to be knocking on your door, anxious to ask a few questions. I never touched him. Didn't even know he was there, said the man who drove there alone and therefore has no alibi. I told you from the start, Ziggy. You're head first in quicksand. Nola slit his throat. No way. She wouldn't. Do not tell me this girl is innocent. Everywhere she goes, she brings one thing with her. Death. Death on a plane. Death on a boat. She's like a walking Agatha Christie novel, and you're playing the part of the plucky and well-meaning investigator who dies right before the ending,
because he's too blind to see the noose that's wrapping around his neck. Staring down at Rookstool's shiny medal for valor, Zig watched his own face twist and shift in its reflection. Did he think that Nola was innocent, incapable of any harm? Of course not. His head was still ringing from that zapping she gave him. Plus, Nola's boss's words. She's a gun. A weapon. But ever since Zig saw her back in Ekron, at the funeral home, the way Nola reacted to the note and the plane crash, some things can't be lied about. Whatever else was going on, no way did Nola put that plane down. Nola, you were right. Keep running. Deep down, he knew it now more than ever. That was a warning. Right there, Zig felt an old thought come back. Previously, he called it a need. But now he saw it more clearly, recognizing it from so many mourners. When it came to Nola, Zig didn't just have a need to know what happened. He had a need to see her in her best light, a need to prove her innocent, a need to prove he was right about her that night at the campfire. It was, he knew, a blind spot, but that didn't mean it was wrong. She knew what she was doing after Marcus's attack, Zig added. If Nola wanted me dead, I'd be dead already. And that makes her a hero? That she slit his throat but not yours? For all we know, Marcus is the one who put the plane down. At that, Wags went silent. Oh, Wags, you looked Marcus up, didn't you? If you found something, what I found is he's no pushover. Marcus was Special Forces. Spent some time at Fort Lewis, then an ugly discharge, though he was clearly still working for someone since, as of yesterday, he had an active ID card. And if he had an active ID, then we can see his last assignment. Took me a while, but apparently he was working on something called Operation Blue Book. Never heard of it. No one had. I checked every database. JWIX, Giant, even Room 11. She added, referencing the cyber warriors who hacked for the NSA, CIA, and a few secret others. This was clearly above, once usually above, top secret. All I was able to find was an address in Washington, D.C., 278 H Street, Southwest. Sounds like a storefront. It is. It's a business that's been around since the early 1960s. And it has something to do with Houdini? You tell me. 278 H Street is home of the Conjuring Arts Eclectic Studio. Alakazam. The last place your attacker was stationed? It's an antique magic shop.
38. Homestead, Florida, 11 years ago. This was Nola when she was 15. Once again, she was sitting in the back. In the art room, on a three-legged stool that wobbled.
Take one, pass them back,
Ms. Sable said, handing a stack of index cards to Sophie Michonne, the smiley student government treasurer who would one day grow up to be the person in her office who, when everyone played Powerball together, would be the one who got left out.
Pass them back,
smiling Sophie repeated to the other students at her four-person workbench. Then her best friend, Missy F., passed them to Harold at his four-person workbench, who passed them to lazy-eyed Justin at his four-person workbench, who walked them to Nola, sitting at her own four-person workbench all by herself.
Don't even try to touch me, Scuzzy,
Justin whispered as he handed Nola the stack of index cards, then flinched as she reached for them.
I heard they put you here to keep you from fighting.
Eat a fart,
Nola growled. This wasn't the first time Nola had been singled out for her art. When she was 5, her kindergarten teacher told the LaPointes that she was coloring too hard, breaking all the crayons, especially the purples. But even then, Nola was determined. If it's purple, it's gonna be purple.
Everyone have one? Good,
Miss Sable said, waving her own index card like a white flag.
On this card, I want you to write down the most important thing in your life. For some of you, that will be your family.
Others, I know, you're teenagers, you hate your family. It can be something different. A boyfriend, girlfriend, your dog, a grandparent, a prized possession. The most important thing, she reiterated. Also, there's no judgment here. It can be a personal philosophy. It can be something you love. Harold, don't look at Sophie for help. Write your own answer. And I know this is high school. Your favorite thing can be sex, for all I care, she added, as the room let out a few nervous giggles. Or it can just be the one item in your house that you'd grab if everything caught fire.
Can I ask a question?
Smiling, Sophie said, Nola noticing that Sophie always prefaced her questions with permission for those questions.
Will anyone else see what we write?
Glad you asked, Ms. Sable said, her arms now crossed, her card tucked into her armpit. No. You will never show me what's on your card. You will never show anyone what's on your card. If it makes you feel better, you can shred it and throw it in the trash for all I care.
Then why even bother writing it down?
Missy F. asked. Because this is art. Art doesn't exist in your head. It exists when you express it, when you let it out, when your pencil hits paper, when your brush hits the canvas. But to create good art, well, whatever you write on this little index card, the most important thing in your life, that's your point of view. Miss Sable stopped, letting the words sink in, something that Nola noticed she did a lot, using silence to make you think. In Nola's own house, sudden silence meant one thing, anger and an imminent explosion. Whatever you draw, Ms. Sable continued, it must relate to what's on this card. Your point of view is what makes you special. It's what makes your art special. Only you can view the world in your way. That sounds like a yoga quote, but it's gospel. Does that make sense? Nola watched the other students shift in their seats. It didn't make sense to most of them. Nola wasn't sure it made sense to her either. For example, Ms. Sable added, when I did this same exercise in art school, I was about to get married. On my card, I wrote, being married. Don't judge, she warned as the class again nervously laughed. God forgive me, but back then, all my art had two of everything in it. Two palm trees, two rivers. Once I even painted two full moons, which doesn't even make scientific sense, especially when you consider how quickly that marriage fell apart. However, that was my point of view. Missy F.'s hand shot into the air.
So it has to be something you love?
It absolutely does not have to be something you love. It can be something you want, something you dream of, something you can't stop thinking about. The only requirement is that it is what you care about most on a daily basis.
Waste of time,
Nola thought, glancing to her left, where Justin the jerkwad was rolling his eyes, shooting a look at one of his friends.
Waste of time,
Justin whispered to Sophie. For a moment, Nola sat there, realizing just how powerful her own spite of Justin's spite was. She stared down at her index card, tempted to doodle a picture of Justin, maybe with a few knives stuffed into his eyes. Instead, she looked up at Ms. Sable, who quickly made eye contact.
Just try it, her teacher pleaded with a glance.
Justin snickered, whispering something to his friends. Grabbing the card, Nola scribbled something quick, then folded it up and stuffed it in her pocket.
Thank you, Ms. Sable said with another glance.
Everyone else, when your card's filled out, take one of these, she added, handing out 9x12 pieces of sketch paper. Whatever you wrote, here's where you put it to work. Make some art. For the next 40 minutes, Nola kept her head down, hunched over her paper as she sketched, stippled, and colored her newest creation. At the front of the room, Ms. Sable took the teacher's stroll that all teachers take, pausing over a few students, offering silent nods, but never coming near the back of the room, never coming near Nola. As the bell rang, Nola was still drawing, her pencil moving at hyperspeed.
Dring!
Nola looked up. Ms. Sable wasn't at the front. She was behind her, staring down, unreadable.
It's not done yet,
Nola insisted.
Nola,
Ms. Sable said, and already Nola could hear the insults, the mistakes, everything bad that was about to be mentioned. I don't know what to say. Nice work. Beautiful start.
Beautiful?
Nola stuttered, not even realizing she said it out loud, like it was a word she didn't understand, or from another language. On the page was a glorious sky, wide and inviting, with ethereal clouds that were rendered with such uncanny, photorealistic detail they looked like you could touch them. On the far right, so small you barely noticed it, was a lone bird. Blackbird? Miss Sable asked.
Raven.
Miss Sable nodded. Cliché for sure, but come on. Nola was 15 and a goth. Also, there was something familiar about the raven. Something elegant. It was in mid-flight, its wings wide as it arced up through the sky, like nothing could stop it. Okay. I kinda wanna salute this, Miss Sable said, putting a hand on Nola's back and adding a squeeze that was the closest thing to a hug that Nola could remember. Told you have a knack, Miss Sable said. Nola felt a smile lift her cheeks. In the coming months, especially when things went bad, Miss Sable would become the most important person in young Nola's life. But of all the things she'd find out about Nola, Miss Sable would never learn about the 6 words that were written on the index card stuffed in Nola's pocket.
He watches me when I sleep.
39. Washington, D.C. Today.
You look lost, a female voice called out.
No, I was just...
Zig paused, looking around.
Okay, I'm definitely lost, he said, scanning the pockmarked street that dead-ended here, in a parking lot for a beat-up soccer field. You don't happen to know where 278 H Street is?
Store or apartment? Asked a young African-American girl, 13 years old, earbuds still in her ears as she walked off the field.
Store. The Conjuring Arts.
What?
It's a magic shop.
Yes, yes, yes. The place where all those white people got jumped.
Zig turned, cocking his head.
I'm kidding. I'm funny,
the girl said, pretending to laugh at her own joke, but really still laughing at Zig. This isn't a bad neighborhood, you know. She was right about that. A decade ago, this area was dominated by drug dealers, gangs, and vacant lots. But when Major League Baseball announced Nationals Park 5 blocks away, a neighborhood sprouted from nowhere, filling the ballpark district with new apartment buildings, shops, and even a 5-acre waterfront park with views to rival Georgetown. Nevertheless, that didn't mean there weren't a few back alleys and side streets that should still be avoided as the sun started to fade, including this one on the back of the junior high school. That your school? Zig asked, wondering if Sue had finally realized he snuck off base. I go to private school, the girl said dryly. St. Peter. For a moment she stood there, twirling her earbuds like she was enjoying herself. You still looking for that magic shop? More than I can possibly express right now. She laughed and pointed to her left. Head toward 3rd Street. Between the tall apartment buildings, there's a little side alley. It's sort of smushed in there, next to the old pawn shop that no one ever goes to. 2 blocks later, Zig spotted a hand-painted sign bolted to a lamppost. Pawn by Yolanda 2. This way. The sun was fading. The sky a gray purple, but even from here Zig could see what was waiting for him. Down the narrow street was a line of painted white brick storefronts, all at the base of 2-story row houses, like old 5 and dimes. 2 were closed, protected by metal roll-down grates. But the 3rd? Zig headed straight for it. In the front window was a vintage neon sign shaped like a fanned deck of cards showing an ace of spades. The neon was dusty, like it hadn't been lit in years. Same with the faded open sign that looked like it hadn't been touched since Nixon was president, which Zig was starting to realize was probably the point. Some places were designed to make sure you look right past them. The Conjuring Arts Eclectic Studio was one of them. You ready? Zig asked into his phone after dialing a quick number.
Listening and recording, Dino said on the other line. Just say the word parachute. I'll call the cops. Nodding to himself, Zig slid his phone into his breast pocket and stepped inside the magic shop.
40. Arlington, Virginia. Nola knew this parking lot was safe. Overhead, she didn't need to check for surveillance cameras. There weren't any. It was a detail of pride for the owners of the restaurant, but also one of necessity. Sandwiched between a 7-Eleven and a takeout Chinese place, the Crystal City restaurant was named like a restaurant. It was built like a restaurant, complete with its brick facade and Christmas wreaths on its trendy outdoor barn lights. It even showed up on credit cards and company receipts like a restaurant. But really, the Crystal City restaurant in Arlington, Virginia, was a strip club, the nearest one to the Pentagon, and therefore one of the least videotaped blocks this close to our nation's capital. For nearly 2 hours, Nola had been parked outside, sitting in her car as she went through Marcus's phone. She'd made a list of every incoming number, every dialed number, every missed call. There were nearly 100 in total, most of them coming up as no caller ID, unknown. Those were the burner phones, or at least those who were smart enough to shut off their tracking. Another 24 gave her, "The number you have dialed has been disconnected or is no longer in service." It used to be to track a phone number to a name, you had to have someone inside the phone company, or at least do what private eyes do and pay $7 a pop to a place like Intellius. Today, all you needed was the right website, which is what Nola was counting on as she opened a browser on her phone. One by one, she entered each number. A few were traceable to a carrier, all to Metro PCS, though they weren't attached to names. Cellular, it read on screen. More burner phones. She then noticed three phone numbers that were in a near-identical sequence. Yet more burner phones, all bought at the same time. She knew this was the tricky part. On the boat, Marcus had given her Houdini's real name, but before she went hunting, she needed to know who else she was up against. Outside, a chubby, bald man in an Elliot in the Morning baseball hat kept his head down as he entered the strip club. His left hand was fidgeting in his pocket. Took off his wedding band and still wasn't used to it. Putz. He shot a quick look at Nola as she entered yet another phone number into the online site. It was a number that hadn't been called in over a month. 240 area code. Western Maryland. Seconds after hitting search, the details appeared on her phone screen. Nola's eyes narrowed. So far, every single hit came up the same. Cellular. Never linked to a name. Always a burner. But there it was. Rare as a dodo. An actual landline. Corporate account. Registered to something called Powell Rock, Inc. Established 1987. Most important? The very best thing that comes with every landline. An address.
41. Washington, D.C. The shop had a metallic smell, like a used bookstore filled with old pennies. As the door closed behind him, puffs of dust cartwheeled through the air. Zig didn't say a word. Better to get a lay of the land. The magic shop was a time machine straight from the 1960s, cluttered with rusty spinner racks and vintage bookcases filled with magic wands, exploding pens, X-ray specs, and everything else that used to be sold in the ads in the back of old comic books. Then Zig's eye caught the stainless steel surveillance camera up on the ceiling. A round lens at the center, with seven little lenses circling it. Thermal imaging. Military hardware. In a decrepit magic shop. "Anybody home?" Zig called out, approaching the L-shaped glass counter. No one answered. Next to the antique cash register was a dirty ashtray and an open can of cream soda. Someone was... "Hope you're not here for the bathroom," a man in his late 80s called out in a southern twang. With a big barrel chest, buzzed gray hair, and a long nose that had outgrown his face, he hobbled out from the back room,
the sound of a toilet still flushing behind him. "Because if you are, I apologize for what I just did in there." "Sounds like my ex-wife," Zig teased, determined to keep things light. "You look like you got something on your mind," the man said as Zig eyed a pale yellow business license underneath the glass counter. "Registered to Joe Janisewski." "Janisewski?" Zig asked, feigning excitement. "My whole family's Polish, though that just gives me lots of vowels in my name." "Haven't been called that in years," the old man said, pointing to a business card taped to the front register. "The Amazing Caesar, greatest magician in D.C., except for the liars in Congress." "I take it you're the owner?" Zig asked. "For the past few years. Original owner is there." He pointed at a Bozo the Clown head up on the wall, stuffed and displayed like a wild animal. Bozo had a perma-smile. It was meant to be a gag. Zig wasn't laughing. "Clown jokes don't seem to land the way they used to." "But at least it keeps the little kids out of here," the old man jested. Though again, it didn't feel like much of a joke. "So what kind of magic can I help you with?" "Just looking for a few supplies. Some mouth coils, a new squeaker. Plus I'm due for a new thumb tip," Zig said, recalling the list he memorized from a magic website. The old man nodded, taking a sip of his cream soda. He had an elderly warmth about him, but dark, doubting eyes, the color of dirt. His hands were big like manhole covers, and though his posture was no longer at its peak, no question, former military. In the field, not behind a desk. An old bruiser. "What size for the thumb tip?" the Amazing Caesar asked. "Usually a medium." "Even though thumb tips are individually measured and don't come in small, medium, or large?" Zig just stood there, feeling the stare of Bozo the Clown, and that thermal camera. "Wanna start again? Maybe without all the horse manure this time?" the old magician challenged. "I'd like to ask a few questions." "About what?" At this point, it made no sense to hold back. "Harry Houdini and Operation Blue Book." "I think you have the wrong person." "Sir, I'm not insulting you, so please don't insult me." "I'm guessing this is a shop and drop, yes?" Zig asked. "The government had them all over the world. People came in and gave a password. If it was right, the shop would give them something they needed. Whatever the case, I know that a man named Marcus Romita came in here before he—" "You're not listening to what I'm saying." Stepping out from behind the main display case, Caesar lumbered toward Zig, putting a hand on his shoulder and shooing him toward the door. "I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know who Marcus is, and if you—" "I'm not your enemy here," Zig said, hands in the air. Caesar kept pushing. He was stronger than he looked. "Sir, if you'll just listen, I don't like liars. Even worse, I don't like people pretending to be magicians so they can case my place." "That's disingenuous bullshit," Caesar said, reaching the door and pulling it open. "Listen to me. My name is Jim Zigarowski. I don't care if you're Elvis Aaron Presley. And I'm from Tennessee, where that still matters. If you don't get out of my shop—" "The crash. Please. The plane that crashed. I know you saw the news. The plane that went down in Alaska." Zig's voice was racing, pleading as he stood there in the threshold, Caesar about to slam the door in his face. 7 people died on that flight. The pilot was 29. An army lieutenant, Anthony Trudeau, was 25. They all died. And one of them—" Zig felt that pill in his neck. The Globus. He swallowed, but it still wouldn't go away. "I'm just asking for 2 minutes of your time. Please. 2 minutes. Caesar looked down his long nose, his dirt eyes unreadable. "I hate watching cable news. It makes you dumber. So I guess I missed it. You have a good day, Mr. Zigarowski." With a slam, the Amazing Caesar was gone, leaving Zig alone in the street, watching the puffs of his own breath. "Okay, so that went crappily," Dino said through the phone as Zig headed back up the block.
That's the very last time I'm buying any Saw a Girl in Half boxes from that magic shop. He knows who Marcus is. I could see it in his face. You knew that 2 hours ago.
Yeah, but now we have his name.
The Amazing Caesar, Sig said, reaching for his car keys and...
Ziggy? You there? You okay?
In his pocket, Zig felt his car keys. And something else. A small, folded-up sheet of paper. Zig pulled it out, confused.
How did...
Unfolding the paper, he read the handwritten message. Capital Skyline Hotel, High Street. 10 minutes. Zig looked over his shoulder, back at the shop. Show-off magicians. 42. Dover Air Force Base, Delaware. There are plenty of places to hold a private meeting at Dover. Staff offices, conference rooms, the clean break room, the medical examiner's room, the chaplain's office, or even the casket storage room. There's also the embalming room and the viscera prep room, which don't allow cameras. But when Master Guns heard that someone wanted to see him here, in this room, accessible only from the back of the building, he knew he wouldn't leave here without some bruises. Lifting a roll-top metal door, Master Guns revealed a long concrete hallway. There were a few doors along the sides, a mop closet and a contamination shower. But Master Guns's attention was focused straight ahead at the dead end. A set of double metal doors reinforced with 5 inches of steel. There was no room number out front, no door handles either. These doors opened only from the inside. Master Guns knew better than to knock. They'd be expecting him. Sure enough, as he approached, the steel door rumbled open. I'm here to see... Not out here, warned a man with a dark suit and a heart-shaped face. He scanned the hallway as he led Master Guns inside. The room was dark. There were no windows. It took a moment for Master Guns's eyes to adjust. People called it a room, but it was really a bunker, its bare walls built with steel-reinforced concrete that was at least a foot thick. Metal on the belt, the man said, pointing Master Guns to one of 2 Rapiscan metal detectors. Now they were just trying to intimidate. You're kidding, right? On the belt, said a second man, also in a dark suit. When fallen service members are carried off the plane at Dover, this is actually their first stop. One by one, each body is run through the scanner to check for unexploded ordnance, concealed IEDs, and any other booby traps that might be hidden on a body. The reinforced walls can withstand just about any blast, except for maybe the one that was coming. Let's go, heart-shaped face added, motioning to the plastic bin by the metal detector. Master Guns unloaded his homicide badge, a pen, a Leatherman combo knife and pliers, and his Beretta 9mm. He then reluctantly pulled off his dog tags and dropped them into the plastic bin. There was a high-pitched beep. A green light went off as he stepped through the scanner. Master Guns was close enough now that he saw the 5-pointed star pin on heart-shaped face's lapel. Secret Service. There were plenty of private places at Dover, but none as private as this. The agent handed Master Guns a thin cell phone that looked like nothing else on the market. Hello, Master Guns said. Please hold for the president, a female voice announced. 43. Washington, D.C. The Capital Skyline Hotel sat on a corner, across the street from a construction lot on one side, a homeless shelter on the other, and diagonally from a McDonald's, which was where Zig parked. For 2 minutes, Zig stared out his front windshield, fighting off the smell of French fries and scanning the hotel for anyone who might be watching. All clear, at least from here. Zig didn't want to be early. He pulled out his phone, looking again at the photos he took yesterday at Nola's office. The painted canvases. He'd forgotten about them until now, but here he was, again staring at the haunting portraits that Nola had done. He swiped left, enlarging the photos of the names on the back. Daniel Graff, Monterey, California. Sergeant Denise Madigan, Kuwait. A quick Google search told him the rest. They had one thing in common. Huh, Sig muttered, making a mental note. He put his phone away and stepped outside. Something to deal with later. Keeping his head down as he walked across the street, Zig entered through a side door, which was marked with its own warning. Doors lock at night. Designed by an architect in the futuristic modular style of 1960s Miami Beach, the Capitol Skyline Hotel aged into one of those outdated concrete behemoths that people hated about downtown D.C., until the family of one of the Studio 54 developers threw millions into the interior, declared it retro, and suddenly, poof, it was chic. Sure enough, as Zig reached the modernist lobby with its chocolate brown leather Barcelona chairs and hip deco wallpaper, the place felt more South Beach than Southwest D.C. "Anything I can help you with?" called a male desk clerk who was a little too handsome for his own good. "Meeting a friend," Zig said, eyeing a nearby couple, two men who could both give the desk clerk a run in the handsome contest. In a place like this, the amazing Caesar would stick out like a turd in a fishbowl. But there was no sign of him. Same in the fancy restaurant. Same when Zig checked the poolside lounge in back. "Nothing, huh?" Dino whispered through the phone as Zig returned to the lobby. "Maybe he got scared," Zig said as two sliding doors opened on his left. Outside, idling in front, was a two-tone 80s-era Lincoln Continental. "Dino, what kind of car did your grandfather drive?" "Same as every pop-pop. His trusty Lincoln, why?" Zig nodded to himself, heading straight for the car. The perfect accessory for an 80-year-old magician. Yet as Zig stepped outside, the car started moving, a slow, easy roll out to the street. Through the window, Zig spotted the driver, a young woman with cat's-eye glasses and those stretch earlobe things that the military would never allow. Just another hipster who didn't realize her trend was over. "Need a cab?" one of the valets called out. "Thanks, I'm set," Zig said, watching the car disappear up the street. "Maybe our shuttle, then?" "No, I'm..." Zig turned to the valet, a lanky kid with acne scars. The valet kept staring, shooting Zig a look. It wasn't a question. "Maybe you'd really like our shuttle," the valet repeated, pointing far too long at the boxy airport shuttle bus with the bright red stripe. "Yeah, no, that's a good idea," Zig said, heading for the shuttle. As he got closer, the shuttle doors didn't open. He tapped the glass with his knuckles. Still nothing. Then he gave them a push, and the bifold doors gave way. Zig climbed the carpeted steps. The driver's seat was empty. But when he looked to his left, in the very last row there was an older man in a tan trilby hat with a pinch front. "Abracadabra, Mr. Zigarowski," the amazing Caesar said. "I should warn you. I'm only doing this because of those people who died. They deserve better. Now, would you mind shutting off your phone? Despite what you think, not all magicians love an audience."
44. Homestead, Florida, 11 years ago. This was Nola when she was 15. It was after school, nearly 5 o'clock. Miss Sable was grading papers as Nola cursed at the charcoal pencil in her hand. According to the syllabus, charcoals wouldn't be introduced until next year in advanced art. But Nola was ready, Miss Sable insisted, teaching Nola that when you work with charcoals, you have to grip them differently than a pencil. "Hold it with your thumb and pointer finger," Miss Sable had explained, holding her own arm up and revealing a glimpse of the tiny initials tattooed on her forearm. "And keep your palm off the page. Charcoals smear." It was that precise detail that had Nola cursing and starting again, rubbing the paper with a kneaded putty eraser that lifted the charcoal off the page.
"I hate this," Nola said.
"Just draw the damn jug," Miss Sable shot back, pointing Nola to the aquamarine water jug at the center of the table. For the next half hour, both were silent, both lost in their work.
This had been Nola's afternoon for weeks now, sketching, drafting, practicing. Extra credit, they called it. For Nola, although she wouldn't know it for years, this time with Ms. Sable, it wasn't a relationship that was simply about art. It was a relationship about respect.
Great, Hera.
Good for you, Sophie, Miss Sable said to herself, flipping to a new sheet of drawing paper and admiring a pencil sketch that smiling Sophie had submitted. It was of Sophie's dog, Flynn, a drooly pug with a wide bow tie that made him look like a Republican.
That's really good,
Nola said, craning her neck to admire Sophie's art. Miss Sable looked up, eyebrows furrowed.
What did you just say?
Miss Sable asked.
Sophie's art,
Nola explained, wondering what she did wrong.
I thought it was good.
Good?
Miss Sable asked.
You don't know enough to know what's good. If you want, you can say you like it, or that you like how it makes you feel, or even say that you love it. But if you ever say that something is good again, you'll be cleaning paintbrushes for the next month. You don't know what good is. After college, after you study form, color theory, perpetual presence, and negative space, then you can tell me what good is. Or when you get a fine arts degree and study the difference between intention and execution, then you'll know what's good. But until then, I'm the teacher. I'll tell you what's good. We clear on that?
Nola nodded, though from the look on her face, she was still clearly confused.
What? Miss Sable asked.
Nola paused, as long a pause as she'd ever done before.
What's college?
45. Washington, D.C. Today. My phone's not on. At the Conjuring Arts, you had it on. And it's on right now, the amazing Caesar said, sliding into the driver's seat, starting the shuttle, and steering the small bus out of the driveway. You get three lies. That's one, Mr. Zigarowski. Zig. Friends call me Zig. Caesar's eyes slid to his right. Zig was sitting in the very first seat of the shuttle, holding the pole like an umbrella. You tell me two more lies, Mr. Zigarowski. This conversation's over. Reaching into his breast pocket, Zig took out his phone. I'll call you back, he whispered to Dina. Yeah, no, don't worry, I'm okay. With a tap, the phone was off. You lost someone in that plane crash, huh? Caesar asked. Zig didn't answer. For what it's worth, it's the one thing I thought you weren't bullshitting about, Caesar added. When it comes to real loss, it never leaves someone's face. Zig glanced upward at the bubble-shaped escape hatch in the shuttle's roof. Bright red letters read, Emergency Exit. Hitting the gas, Caesar spent the next 2 minutes hunched in the driver's seat, his pointer and middle fingers on the steering wheel at the 5 and 7 o'clock positions. Old man out for a casual ride. You said you felt bad those people died. What do you know about it? Zig asked. Caesar just drove. Can you at least tell me where we're going? Zig added. I like parks, Caesar said, turning the corner and pulling to the side of the road in front of a large abandoned lot with a state-of-the-art construction trailer on it. The shuttle lurched and shuddered, Caesar not yet used to the hard clench of its brakes. Plus, I like knowing who's sniffing after me. Zig looked out the side window of the bus. This part of the neighborhood was far less developed, a scattering of open lots with no restaurants or buildings nearby. If anyone was following, they'd be impossible to miss. Pretty soon, the corporate bomb will hit, and this block will be covered in Starbucks and Paneras. But no matter how much money they pour in, this town still won't be able to produce a proper slice of pizza, Caesar said. By the by, guess how much that valet kid wanted from me to borrow his shuttle? Zig was still staring out the side window. From this distance, the 60s-era hotel, lit up at night and dotted with its TV-shaped windows, looked like a tiny concrete beehive, which brought an odd sense of calm to Zig. something safe from home, right here in a spot where he felt so uniquely off balance. "I'd like to know about Operation Blue Book," Sig insisted. "Do me a favor first. Watch the key," the amazing Caesar said, pulling the key from the ignition. The shuttle went dark, the only light now coming from a shattered street lamp with an exposed bulb. "Still see the key? Now I want you to hold it for me," Caesar said, swiveling his seat toward Zig and handing it over. "I don't have time for a magic trick."
"Mr. Zigarowski, if there was ever time for a magic trick, this is most definitely it."
His voice was deadpan, but as he started doing his act, you could see hints of the natural performer buried underneath. "Now I want you to put the key in this envelope," he added, pulling a crisp, letter-sized envelope from his jacket pocket. Humoring him, Zig took the key and slid it into the envelope. "Seal it with a lick," Caesar said. "Don't worry, I didn't poison it." Zig looked down at the envelope, then licked it, sealing the key inside.
"Now what do you suppose is the big ta-da of the trick?"
"I honestly don't care. I don't like magic. The only reason I know why you're here, Mr. Zigarowski. Your commitment to repetition makes it nauseatingly obvious. I'm trying to illustrate a point. When it comes to magic, do you know how many tricks there are?"
"I don't know.
Thousands."
"Don't let sarcasm mask frustration. There are four. That's it. Sure, there's levitation with all their strings and wires, and there's escape stuff which relies on gimmicked cuffs and other gaff. But for the rest of them, there are only four different magic tricks. You make something appear. You make something disappear. You make two things change place. Or you change one thing into something else. Everything in magic is a variation on those four."
"So what's that have to do with Operation Blue Book?" Swiveling back toward the steering wheel, Caesar stared out the front window, pursing his lips, like he was trying to touch his top lip to his nose.
"You military, Mr. Zigarowski?"
"Never enlisted, but I work with our troops. Mortician. Dover Air Force Base."
"Mortician? No wonder you hate magic.
You were saying something about Blue Book.
Just that... you were right before. My store. It's a shop and drop. People come in and we do a little challenge and password. I say the prearranged phrase. If they reply with the right password, well, sometimes I make something appear. Sometimes I make it disappear."
"And people pay you for that?"
"No, no, 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 no."
He shook his head, still staring out the front window.
"I don't do this for profit. I do this for..."
He stopped.
"I've got one client. My dear old Uncle Sammy."
"So you do work for the government?" Again he tried to touch his top lip to his nose.
"How old are you, Mr. Zigarowski?"
"Late 40s. 52.
"Mm-hmm. You got lucky with that head of hair. Lady Time picks her lovers with care."
"You were saying about the government."
"When I enlisted, I was 17. World War II was long done, but even then, to see how our troops were treated. Someone gave my older brother a car, a used 1938 Ford Prefect, and that got him a wife, so... I gave Uncle Sammy a fake age I wanted in so bad. The Marines said no, but the Navy put me in a wetsuit and let me be a frogman long before there were SEALs. When they saw I could read, they sent me to officer's school. But in military life, you know, you turn 40. If you're lucky, you turn 50. And then..."
"No one gets old in the military," Sig said.
"No, you can get old. You just get less useful,"
the amazing Caesar said, staring out the front windshield like he was looking at something he couldn't quite bring into focus.
"It's the hardest part of aging. You don't even notice it at first. But boy, does that phone stop ringing." So when a colonel called me up one day and asked me if I could take a shipment for him in the magic shop, Mr. Zagorowski, it was like being at the prom and having the prettiest girl ask you to dance and then whisper in your ear that she wants to... I think I got it. I'm not sure you do. My job at the Conjuring Arts, I take pride in my shop. I built the wooden bookshelves, built the awning out front. I built it all with my own hands. And I was happy with it. But when that colonel called up and asked for help, the shock of adrenaline, the electricity shooting through me, that's the real magic of life. That's what feeds us. That need to be needed. You say you're 52, Mr. Zagorowski? You're telling me you never got a charge from a need like that? For a moment, Zig stared out his window, focusing on the beehive-shaped hotel, his tongue tapping against his sharp incisor. Not really. Caesar made a noise, part laugh and part humph. You say you're a mortician. You should know better than anyone. Just because you're not dead doesn't mean you're alive. I appreciate the advice, but I know that's not the reason you brought me out here in the middle of... I brought you out here because people were killed, Caesar snapped, his voice showing its first hint of... not just anger, guilt. 7 people, yes. I need to make that right. I appreciate that, sir. So if we can get back to the colonel, what kind of shipments was he asking you to take? You're assuming I'm a bad person, Mr. Zagorowski. This isn't some crooked underground operation. It's a necessity of military life.